Well, hi again. This is Bob Brundage, and today is February the 23rd, 2005. And today we have the pleasure of talking with Kip Garvey out in California. So
I used to say that young caller.
That young, you're right. So I'm anxious to hear all about Kip's involvement in square dancing over the years. So, Kip, why don't you tell us where you're born and brought up, and we'll take it from there.
I was born in Lawrence, Massachusetts, raised in North Andover. Born in 1947, so I guess I'm a war baby, an official war baby, of the big one. And I was born in Lawrence, and I went to Central Catholic School in Lawrence, high school. And lived in North Andover, as I said, and that's where my first exposure to square dancing occurred, in the Andover, North Andover region.
Yeah.
My parents learning to dance with Rocketeers, I believe was the name of the club, out of sponsored by Raytheon Corporation out of Andover. And at that time, I guess maybe 1960s, about this time frame, actually closer to 1958, I started dancing with my sister.
Okay. In Andover, you mean?
In Andover,
yeah.
At the Rocketeers. Actually, the club was, at that time, it was huge. The beginner class was filled the Punchett High School auditorium. And it was probably in the neighborhood of 40 squares, maybe 50 squares in the beginning.
Wow. Yeah. That's great. Well, did you come from a musical family or not?
Well, in a very informal way, my dad had served in the Pacific Front and was associated in some way with the USO shows that would travel through.
Yeah.
He was a drummer himself.
Uh-huh.
And kind of a jazz aficionado. And
okay.
He, again, it was very informal.
Yeah.
We didn't have any formal training back in those days.
But. Right. So you started out, in other words, going through classes with your sister, is that it?
Yeah, my sister and I were partnered with each other. The class was an adult class, and apparently we started a wave of activity where the young people were, I mean, I guess the parents were beginning to bring the young people in.
Oh, that's great.
And Paul Pratt was the teacher of that time. He was
the
caller.
Okay, I was just going to ask you who that was.
Yeah, and he was exceptional. He was a very good teacher.
Sure.
He, through no fault of Paul's, of course, the club had decided that they wanted to separate the teens and preteens from the adult class.
Yeah.
And at that time, there was not much available by the way of teen organizations in that area.
Yes.
A young man by the name of Bob Bailey was learning how to call over in Andover.
Okay.
And he began to run classes in the basement of a home of his significant other.
Yeah.
I forget her last name. Her first name was Sandra. And Bob was a teenager himself, I would say probably in the neighborhood of 17, 18 years old.
Yeah.
While we were 12 and 13. And we basically learned to dance in Sandra's basement.
Uh-huh.
With Bob Bailey.
Okay.
I mean, that's where we actually finished our classes.
Yes.
And I had coerced a handful of my friends from school to come in, and Sandra had a younger sister, and she brought some friends in. So we had about a square and a half, two squares that were learning how to dance while Bob was learning how to call.
Yeah. Okay. So when did you get interested in calling?
Well, right around the time that Bob Bailey got drafted.
Uh-huh.
Bob had just started, I believe, the club was officially started as the Twilight Twirlers in Andover.
Okay.
And it later grew to be a very large teenage club. But Bob, unfortunately, got drafted or chose to enlist rather than get drafted, one or the other.
Yes.
And we showed up one Sunday to dance at Sanders' house, and there was no caller.
Uh-huh.
So they were apologizing and trying to send us home. And I said, well, you know, let's get out and spin some records anyway and give it a try.
Sure.
So one thing led to another, and I picked up the microphone and tried to call. Well, I had men boxing the net with men and people unable to do the call. It was a mess. And I was derided by my friends, which was about all I needed to catapult me into a frame of mind saying, well, there's no magic to this stuff. I'm going to learn how to do it.
Sure. You took up the challenge. You know? Right. Well, that's really great. So over the years, who would you say were some of your mentors?
Oh, there were quite a few. Of course, Paul Pratt. I immediately turned to Paul and asked him if he would give me some training. He was very polite and very business-like and charged me $6 a session.
Uh-huh.
Which I had to come up with. At that time, I wasn't even driving. I had to hook a ride over to Lowell,
yeah.
And Paul would run me through a few training sessions and calling.
Yeah.
He was probably the first teacher that I had. He had a fairly well-organized training curriculum that he had put together himself.
I see.
And Jim Mayo at the time was calling, and a lot of the familiar names in New England. Charlie Baldwin, of course, was running the New England Square Dance Caller magazine.
Yes.
And let's see, Dick Steele was a very prominent caller,
right,
in the area. And of course, this is all within the framework of let me put this in lowercase letters so we understand that not everybody agrees with this definition, but this was within the framework of what we call modern Western square dancing.
Right.
And I didn't have much experience in square dancing that existed prior to modern Western square dancing. Almost
yes.
All of my training and upbringing in the activity was centered around the very fast learning pace,
yes,
and the rapidly changing environment of calls and figures and terminology,
yes,
and I think the very first formal college school I attended was the East Hill Farm.
Oh yes,
with Earl Johnston and Dick Jones, Dick and Artie Jones.
Yes.
And another caller that you may or may not be familiar with, his name is Al Brundage.
Oh, yeah, I think I remember him, right. Yeah.
He's a kid brother, right?
Well, yes and no.
Yes and no.
No, he's a little older than I am, but that's all right. Go ahead.
Well, I was trying to be facetious, not evidently not successfully. But at any rate, that was a great exposure.
Sure.
At that time, there wasn't very many resources for learning how to call.
Right.
There were hardly any. And I had just a voracious appetite for it. I just needed to know what everybody else knew about calling. So
yes.
Anytime I had a chance, I would... I was a little bit more bold than most young people should be, I think. But I would call her, no pun intended, the nearest pro that I could find and try to find out what it was all about.
Yes.
Choreography and presentation.
Right.
I remember an experience I had with Ed Gilmore.
Okay.
Where I was actually able to get him aside and talk to him one-on-one. And that was an eye-opener, because here is an individual who self-admittedly supported is it okay for me to say the birth of modern Western square dancing from a teaching aspect?
Right.
And had developed a lot of the curriculums for teaching square dancing in an organized modern Western type of environment.
Yes.
Meaning, of course, that he was partially responsible for abstracting out the basic calls.
Yes.
And putting them onto a list and a program and then presenting them so that people could dance them in an extemporaneous fashion.
Right.
Rather than a complete memorized dance routine.
Yes.
And yet, on a one-on-one, even back in those days, Ed Gilmore had said to me that he's not sure that that was the way to go.
Yes.
And I can still remember that comment. And in light of the way square dancing, modern Western square dancing anyway, is going today, I think that that Ed Gilmore showed a perception that was not only true, but
right.
But very accurate. And that was back in 1964-65.
Okay, right.
So the exposure that I had at that time to a lot of my parents' friends got me involved in teaching my first adult class, which later developed into a club called the Scarlet Squares.
Okay.
Dot and Stan Hart.
Okay.
Were big promoters of the young Kip Garvey, I guess you might say. And,
right.
And helped me get that launched. Later on, I picked up another club in Woburn.
Uh-huh.
I've been struggling to remember the name of it, actually, but it was a huge club. And we had beginner classes that would just jam. We had a waiting list. People had to wait until the following season.
Right.
Sometimes to come into the class. It was just so huge at that time, Bob. It was incredible.
I know.
When I look back on it, how popular it was.
Yes.
And the size of beginner classes, and we put everybody, it was the Tarkey School in Woburn, and we put everybody into that hall that we could. We even had to limit some of the club members from coming in and angeling.
Yes.
Because the classes were so big. We were running 20, 22 squares.
Yes.
In the classes, and that was wall to wall. And that was an interesting experience for a young caller, because we had there was an eight-sided hall. There were eight sides to that hall. It was interesting trying to convince everybody that the heads were lined up with the heads.
Right.
Because the men's and ladies' rooms were on one wall, so we said, that's where the heads are.
Yeah, okay.
And the whole development of square dancing at that time was extremely rapid. There were a lot of young callers getting involved.
Do you remember who some of them were?
Buzz Chapman in Massachusetts, who later became involved in politics out in western Massachusetts.
Did he? I didn't know that.
Yeah, he and I were about the same age, and he started calling before I did, and he had a great reputation as a caller.
Yes, I remember Buzz. Yeah.
And later on, it turned out, I think he went into banking and then went into politics.
Huh.
Jack O'Leary.
Yes.
Was a caller at the time.
Yeah, he's still busy today
doing
got
a, it.
Got his own record company.
Has his own record company. Back in those days, there weren't very many full-time callers.
Right.
Earl Johnson was one.
Yes.
That I recall. I remember going out to a, the whole club of teens went out to a, I'm trying to think of the name of the town, I think it was Westwood, Mass, out to a weekend that was run by a gal by the name of Gloria Roth.
Oh, yes.
And actually, it was Gloria Rios at the time.
Right.
And what I remember about it was not only the excellent dancing and training that we were getting, but she ran it. She ran the whole camp like it was a military organization. She really did.
That's
to
glorious.
The point where my father got caught swimming in the pool when it wasn't pool time.
Oh.
And she had heard about it or somehow got wind of it while she was calling. She put the microphone down in the middle of a tip and ran out and just scolded my dad.
That's glorious.
That's glorious. And shoot him right out of the pool.
Yeah, that's funny.
We had a lot of local talent in New England at the time. That Joe Prestupa,
yep.
Joe Portalance,
yep.
There were a lot of Skip Smith.
Yep, right.
There were a lot of New England just seemed to be just a warehouse of calling talent.
Right.
There was a lot going on.
Well, of course, that was about the time that some of the barns started to open.
Yeah, Kramer's Hayloft, we called there, Johnson's Barn.
Yeah.
I remember doing a New Year's Eve there.
Bay Path
Barn with Chet.
Yeah.
And Dot and Stu Allen over at Allen's Homestead.
Right.
Eventually, after calling for several years, and once I got out of college, I started an organization called Partners in Progress, and we focused in on, in those days it was called Advanced Workshops, before Advanced was actually the name of the program.
Right.
And, but that was not unique, because almost all of the callers at the time who were calling regularly had their own closed workshops.
Yes.
Red Bates had a group called Experimental Squares.
Right.
John Hendren had a group called Jets.
Yes.
And so Kip Garvey had an open advanced workshop group called Partners in Progress.
There you go.
We had multiple locations.
Okay.
We called it Lynn. We had an operation in Lynn at Allen's Homestead. Later on at Bay Path Barn at the same time.
Yes.
We had one in Andover. And at that time, people were just so hungry for the new calls and the new routines.
Right.
And they were just very well attended.
Yeah.
Managed to bump into, of course, I got very friendly with John Hendren. He's a unique individual.
Oh, yes.
And so talented. He had gotten together with Ken Anderson. Together they had formed a record company, J-Bar-K Records.
Right.
And I had my first recording opportunity on J-Bar-K Records.
Yes.
And I recorded several tunes with them. Later, Mick Howard on Thunderbird Records gave me an opportunity to call. And I recorded with Mick one of... probably one of the best records that I ever recorded as far as sales go, called Chic of Chicago. And
what was that name again?
The name of the tune was Chic of Chicago.
Oh, Chic of Chicago, okay.
And the strange thing is that that piece of music had been sitting in Mick Howard's cans for a couple of years.
Huh.
And he just didn't have... anybody on his team that he really wanted to record wanted to do the recording, and he sent it up my way, and it ended up being a great opportunity for me.
Well, great. Okay, well, going back a little bit, Kip, what about some of the festivals and so forth that were going on around? Did you ever get involved in them?
Oh, sure. Of course, the New England Convention was the annual thing,
yeah,
which was run in a sense, it was a microcosm of the National Convention, the way it was run.
Sure.
The different cities in New England would bid on hosting, and it would be held in a high school complex of some sort. It would use multiple facilities. Buses would carry the people around from hall to hall.
Right.
And callers would volunteer their time to call.
Yes.
Probably, aside from that, I started doing the festival circuit, I believe. One of the first ones I did was the Delaware Valley Convention, which was a big festival at the time.
Yes.
And getting the invitation to do Delaware Valley was a result of the first traveling loop that I had set up, where I would travel out through, I guess it was Interstate 90, out through Ohio, western Pennsylvania and into Ohio, and swing back down into Pennsylvania and back through the Delaware Valley.
Yes.
And I did that loop about twice a year. And, you know, I called it State College and a lot of the different towns. And
right.
That's where I bumped into Curly Custer, and we had a great relationship with Curly over the years.
Oh, great.
It was, you know, I'm just such a unique talent.
Yes.
I learned so much from Curly, and he just made sure I learned it.
Yeah, that's true.
And I learned a lot from Curly. Like at one particular festival out in Olean, New York, it was a big festival, afternoon and evening dance, and it was very large. And they had a split the pot thing that they did, and son of a gun if I didn't win the afternoon pot, and it was about $390 or something. And of course, Curly was working with me on the stage, and right away he said, and of course, Kit's going to donate this back to the club, and everyone goes, yay! And I'm going, oh my God. So I said, of course I will. And as luck would have it, during the evening session, the split the pot was over $500, and Curly held the ticket. So turnaround is fair play.
Oh, that's funny.
And the club walked off with their half and ours.
Yeah, right.
So it was great.
Great
fun with Curly over the years.
Do you talk to him anymore?
I haven't had a chance to talk to Curly in I bet 15 years.
He's living in Florida now.
Oh, is he?
Yeah. I'll send you his email address if you'd like.
That'd be great. That'd be great.
Sure.
Is Ruthie still with him?
Yes, yep.
Great.
Yep.
Great.
Okay.
And he was trying to sell his dad's airplane design.
Yeah, I know. I was just about to ask you about that if you ever...
Yeah, the Channel Wing. I wanted to build a radio-controlled version of it.
Oh, did you?
I never quite got the plans from him.
Ah, well, that was a unique design. It's too bad the aeronautical people turned him down for licensing, you know.
Yeah. Well, but, I don't know how that all happened, but...
Yeah, it's... Well, probably...
He was the only other caller I knew that had... there was one other caller I knew that had a promotion, shall we say, going on the side.
Yeah.
And that was, out of Texas, Black Mountain Records.
Les Gotcher, yeah.
Who amazingly impressed me so much with his unique card on him.
Right.
I mean, the guy was off the wall. Anybody that could call a whole night of nothing but hash and do one singing call in the middle and sell the singing call.
I mean,
I don't think I'm being critical.
No.
In a sense, when I say that, you know, that there was no melody.
No, right.
It was a singing call because I think it had a refrain that repeated seven times.
That's right.
Other than that, it was the same thing as that.
Yep, exactly.
And he was an amazing talent.
Yes.
I really did appreciate working with him one last time at the Washington Spring Festival when they had him come back.
Oh, yes.
As a guest caller. And that was another festival I did that was very large. It was the Washington Spring Festival.
Oh, yes.
And the Washington Fall Cotillion that Deco Deck used to run.
Oh, yes.
And I did that festival for many years also. And, you know, Bob, I had the greatest absolutely unequivocally the greatest young life that any young man could ever have. I met the greatest people. I met some of the most sincerely talented people, people who were very giving. They taught me a lot, and I'll always be thankful for the exposure I had through those years.
Right.
The festivals that I did were great. They were the reward that I think that I got for working as hard as I did and learning my trade. And I did. I worked very hard.
Yes.
My dad gave me that that ethos when I was very young. He did not want me to call, but finally, when he decided that I was going to do it, he sat me down once and he said, "You're going to do this right, or you're not going to do it at all."
Right.
And he set down one guideline for me. He said, 2 hours a day, you'll work at your calling.
Uh huh.
Whether it's listening to a tape, whether it's writing choreography, or whether it's actually calling.
Right.
And that was the best advice I ever got because I did it. And I think it really helped.
Oh, sure. Right. Well.
My dad was a very quiet guy. Not very free with the compliments. And it wasn't until I was 27 years old that he came to me after I was calling a dance, and he said, "Kip, that was fabulous. That was the best overall performance from 8 to 11 that I've ever heard."
Yeah.
And that was the very first time that my dad came to me with a compliment like that.
That's great. That's great. Well, how about national conventions?
I did a few. The national conventions were disappointing for me.
Yes.
I think a lot had to do with the fact that my age at the time.
Uh-huh.
Philadelphia. Let's see, I did Atlantic City. I did Philadelphia. I did Milwaukee. Louisville, Kentucky. Oh, God. Anaheim.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I was at the Anaheim Convention where it was wall-to-wall people, 44,000.
Yeah. No, I thought you would have been accepted out there because they had some nice young callers. Buzz Brown used to yodel all the time.
I was accepted. I don't think that was the problem.
Oh.
I think it was personal more than anything else.
Oh, I see. Okay.
I just really believe that I experienced a lot of shuffling around.
Yeah.
Reprogramming.
Well, it was a rat race, no doubt about it.
Yeah, and I'm sure it happened to a lot of the callers.
Yeah.
And I simply had to look back and say,
yeah.
At that time in my life too, I was trying to raise a young family and call, and wasn't a full-time caller either. I was teaching school at the time, so it was difficult for me to get to break free and get the time off.
Sure. Which brings up the subject that we should talk about, where you met your wife and when and so forth.
I met my wife in college.
Okay.
We were actually in college together. And we were married, I guess, about 9 months after graduating. So in 1968. And we both taught school. We both were certified teachers and moved out to central Massachusetts. And she taught in Framingham, Mass. And I taught in, I went out the other way to Warren, Mass.
Oh, yeah.
Taught in a regional school system.
Okay.
So I taught school for 7.5, 8 years. And then I went into the insurance business with my cousin, who was an independent insurance agent and had a Cushing, Crispin, Potter & Payne was the name of the company. And they were in Framingham. I picked up my license and sold insurance for property and casualty insurance and some life insurance for about 4 years, 5 years. With them. At the same time, I picked up my real estate license. And so I was kind of a jack of all trades.
Yeah, well, you were actually never actually a full-time caller then.
Well, I was, but not until around 1975.
Oh, I see.
In 1975, it was coming together for me to a point where I could actually pull the plug on the daytime jobs.
Right.
Go full-time in calling.
Yes.
I'm not so sure that was the wisest decision I've made, but that was certainly what I did at the time.
Right, right.
And,
were you ever involved in any Square Dance weekends?
Oh, sure. We had, I used to work with Curly Custer at Hagerstown.
Uh-huh.
Not at Hagerstown, at, what's the name of that place? Curly gave me the first opportunity to do weekends with him.
Uh-huh.
The junction of the two rivers. I can't remember the name of it.
Well, he lived in Hagerstown.
He lived in Hagerstown, but this was west.
Okay.
Hagerstown.
Well, it doesn't matter.
Junction of the Shenandoah. And
yeah.
Anyway, that was a great opportunity, too, to be able to do that. And at that time, I was a pilot. I'd picked up my private pilot's license, and there was a dancer down there that used to fly up to Massachusetts in his Mooney. And we'd fly back again and fly down, do the weekend, and he'd fly me back.
Uh-huh.
So, and I was doing some flying around the area. Didn't do too much, but that's how I ran into Bob Fisk, who, of course, at that time was selling. He was selling airplanes for Bonanza.
Oh, I didn't know that.
He was.
I knew he was a pilot, but I didn't know he sold airplanes.
Yeah, he was. He did actually. I don't know how official that was, whether he was full time at it or not. But that's what he did.
Yeah.
Beechcraft was the name of that company.
Oh yes.
He sold some Beechcraft products.
See, I'll learn something new every day. Right.
I did. Dick Jones was probably my number one mentor at the time.
Uh-huh.
Dick took me under his wing, and later on at the Milwaukee Convention, one of the last ones that we all did together, we went out at the after parties. It was Dick Jones, it was Kip Garvey, Wade Driver, and Tony Oxendine. Very young Tony Oxendine. And we were going to the after parties and calling, and we had a ball.
Yes.
And it was later that we found out that we were all students of Dick Jones, the three of us.
Uh-huh.
And we had all mentored under him. And Dick was great. I mean, he not only had that remarkable talent, but he was also very free in giving of himself and helping
yes.
you anytime he needed help. So
yes.
he had a weekend in the Pocono Mountains that I was doing.
Right.
And up in the Catskill Mountains also.
Yes.
And I was doing weekends with Curly, and that, I mean with Dick, and that's how I got to meet a lot of the callers.
Right.
That like Bob Fisk and so on. And Marshall Flippo.
Yeah, right.
What a package. That Flippo was something else.
Yeah, he was just here in town. I picked him up at the airport and took him to the dance and so forth. But,
well, I told him one time, I said, Flippo, you're going to be around forever, so when we're all gone, will you turn out the lights?
Yeah.
He's just that amazing.
There's a good story about Flippo. I might as well interject. I interviewed Herb Eggender, who was an assistant executive director of Caller Lab at one time. And when he was interviewed for the job by John Kaltenfaller and Flippo, John said to him, Herb, he said, you don't do much traveling, do you? You don't travel a lot. And Herb said, no, he said, I kind of prefer the dance that I don't have to leave town the first thing the next morning. And Flippo went right over backwards in his chair.
I remember I did a weekend with Flip in Cincinnati.
Yeah.
And we left Sunday morning to go to the airport, and we happened to see Flippo had left early. It was Easter, like an Easter weekend. He wanted to get back down to Texas. And it was just before Thanksgiving. That's when it was. It was just before Thanksgiving. He wanted to make sure he got back to Texas for Thanksgiving, so he had left early that Sunday morning. And as we were leaving town, we happened to notice that Flip's car was on the side of the road by the outside of the hall. And as it ended up, as he had left for the dance, he got out to the street, and the police had him arrested. He was, spread eagle up against the car, and they put him in the car, and they and they took the cruiser, and they took him to the police station. And what had happened was it was a case of mistaken identity.
Oh, I'll be darned. No, I didn't know that.
And I remember he told me the story, and I said, Flip, how can anybody mistake you for anybody else?
Right. Right.
My.
Well, so you've made several recordings.
Yes, I met, I did Chic of Chicago, which gave me a heavy boost as a young traveling caller.
Yeah.
And I ran into Wade Driver, who at that time had just started Rhythm Records.
Right.
At the Atlantic City Convention, and he and I, at that time he had just released You Ring My Bell.
Yes.
Which was a huge hit.
Right.
And I think that every hall you walked into in Atlantic City, that's what the caller was calling.
Yeah.
That was the singing call.
Yeah.
And so I met Wade there, and he and I talked, and we hit it off, and so he invited me to join Rhythm Records. And I remember the first time that I flew to Houston, to go to a recording session. And the guys down there were pretty generous, Bob Beyer and Pat Barber and Wade, had given me a couple of nights to call while I was there, too.
Yes.
So I left New England, as I usually do, and at that time, you can imagine that was a time of leisure suits and some pretty flagrant colors and color schemes. So I get off the airplane in Houston, Texas, in my mint green leisure suit with white patent leather shoes.
Right.
And these three guys, like, disappear.
Yeah.
And finally, Pat Barber comes to me and he says, "Hey, little brother, we're all going to take you to a jeans place real soon."
Right.
And they outfitted me in my first pair of blue jeans.
For there you go. There you go.
And again, a cowboy hat and all that stuff.
Right. Right.
But I joined the Rhythm staff, and I honestly think we made history. In a small way, the synergy between the four of us was a package that had never existed before in
right.
The modern Western square dancing scene. We did music that was creative. Wade was super creative.
In his music.
We did several weekends, festivals a year, and we did four-part harmony that was tight.
Ah. Okay.
And it was new at that time. All of the things that we did at our Rhythm Records weekends were just innovative.
Yes.
And the country western dancing, for instance, which later became a huge hit in California, and you couldn't go to a festival without it, even to this day. We basically started that at after party events.
Uh-huh.
In Texas, and then later on in California.
Okay.
So we had a wonderful experience in the years I was associated with Rhythm Records.
Right.
And in 1979, I moved from Massachusetts to California and started up my calling operation out here in San Francisco Bay Area.
Uh-huh.
And it was quite a quite a transition.
Yeah, gosh, I didn't realize you moved out there that early.
Yeah, it was 1979. We've been out here quite a while now.
Yeah.
And in 1980, I started a festival out here called Winter Festival.
Uh-huh.
And it originally was the Rhythm Records callers. And to this day, I mean, even this past January, we had our 25th Winter Festival event.
Yes.
So California's been very, very good to me. All of square dancing has been good to me. I mean, I owe my college education to square dancing.
Sure.
I owe most of my young adult life to square dancing. It was really a true mainstay of my upbringing.
Sure.
And I let me tell you, you couldn't do any worse.
Yeah.
You couldn't do any better, I should say. I mean, you could do a whole lot worse.
Well, you'd probably describe the experience as many others have, that you were in the right place at the right time.
That's true.
Yeah.
And square dancing itself had reached a peak. My involvement in Color Lab was a method that I used to try to give a little back.
Yes.
And I had a long tenure with Color Lab. From 1984 on, I believe.
Okay.
No, I'm sorry, 1978 on.
Okay.
Call that.
Yes.
And it was around 1984, 1986, that I ran into a fellow by the name of Bill Davis out here in California.
Right.
And Bill Peters.
Yes.
Bob Van Antwerp, who I dearly loved. I mean, if I loved his syncopated rhythms, as he called.
Yes.
He had such a relaxing delivery.
Yes.
I learned from him on tape and never got to meet the man until several years later. I mean, I was studying his tapes back in the late 60s and early 70s and never got to meet him until the early 80s.
Uh-huh.
And just an amazing... And a gentleman. Oh, just a terrific person to know.
Yes.
But Van Antwerp was a huge influence on my calling style. The move here to California, and I got involved with Bill Davis and Bill Peters, and we sat down and began to analyze what was going on in square dancing. And from about 1986 on, I was writing articles, making strong editorial statements regarding how fragile the activity had become.
Yes.
And with the influence of so many calls, the programs that Call Lab had espoused were the right way to go, I feel, and yet... I think at the mainstream part of the program that it was an overreaction, that they had frozen it too much. Modern square dancing needs change. It's defined by change. It's what makes it different.
Yes.
From any square dancing that occurred before. And yet there was a huge element within the mainstream community that was adverse to any change whatsoever.
Right.
The number of calls that people had to learn was it's just way too many.
Yes.
In my opinion. I carried that opinion through the 80s, late 80s and early 90s. I worked in Call Lab to try to make the changes. And it was just recently that I finally put down my gavel and retired from the battle, because I felt like I'd been ineffective and not unappreciated, but ineffective.
Yes.
In making some positive changes and trying to alert square dancing leadership that the activity was in danger.
Yes.
So I don't claim to be clairvoyant or anything, but to me it was very evident, but it was such a hard sell. The callers, through that whole area, through that whole era, seemed to be singularly focused.
Yes.
They all wanted to be superstars. They all wanted to be the ones doing the festivals.
Yes.
They all wanted to be the ones doing the privately closed-held workshops.
Yes.
They all wanted to know about choreography. We would run these week-long caller schools. And if you weren't talking about psych calling, they weren't listening to you.
Yes.
And it was such a shame because they were missing so much of the true spirit, characterization, and body of square dancing and focusing on these mechanics that, in the long run, didn't amount to anything.
Right.
It was like a carpenter. A carpenter has a skill set where he can work with wood and make things happen. But he has to have the vision. And if he doesn't have the vision to see what's going to work in what place, then his skill set is useless.
Right.
But that's the way it was.
Yeah.
And there was nobody to listen to a second opinion, so to speak.
Right.
And I have to admit, I was a technician. That was my focus. I'm an engineer today.
Right.
And I'm attracted to the technical aspects of choreography.
Yes.
I knew about them. I wrote about them. I created a lot of the phraseology and coined some of the phrases that we use today. I've written many calls. But that was only one aspect of my calling.
Sure.
And I feel like, I taught beginner classes almost every year that I was a caller.
Right.
For 42 years, I taught beginner classes.
Yes.
And,
right.
So it was difficult for me to convey that.
Yes.
Everybody wanted to know about the secret get out.
Here.
You know, and how to make, you know, how to make the crowd go crazy.
Yes.
But they didn't want to learn about teaching.
Yeah.
And what makes things happen and how clubs are formed and how they're held together.
And how to move to music and
move to the music. I mean, it's there. It's
right.
Music. There was a time when they were downselling the music. They were actually saying you don't need any rhythm to be a square dancer. And I was thinking to myself, yeah. And you know, you don't need rocket fuel to go to the moon either.
Right.
But try to do it without it.
Yes.
So I think square dancing had evolved beyond Kip Garvey.
Yes.
I think maybe all of us reached that point where we feel not burned out, but just ineffective.
Yes. Yeah.
Where the reality of square dancing is different from the image that we have.
Yes. Skip, we're just about the end of the tape, and what I'd like to do is stop for a second and turn the tape over because there's still a few more questions I'd like to ask. So why don't you just hold on, and I'll come back in a minute.
Okay, Bob.
Okay, we're back on the air.
You want to put the pause button on for a minute?
Okay. So getting back to Kip again, I wanted to ask you, Kip, if you ever got involved with contra dancing at all.
I danced it, and, you know, I really enjoyed it. It was, and it continues to be, a highly popular form of square dancing, American square dancing. It's never had the highlight or the spotlight on it as modern Western square dancing has had, and I think that's a shame because it's an amazingly it offers in many regards more than what today's modern Western square dancing offers.
Right.
Modern Western square dancing today is an intellectual activity.
Yes.
Where the appreciation of music and dancing aspects have been not eliminated, but let's say placed on the back burner.
Right.
Contra dancing, on the other hand, focuses on the music and the ability of music to bring people together.
Right.
And the sociability that goes with it.
Yes.
I danced in think the name of the town, Lincoln, Mass. Ted Sine, is that?
Sinella. Ted Sinella.
Ted Sinella.
Right.
I was able to walk into Ted, and because he didn't know me from a hole in the wall, and just dance a couple of nights.
Yeah.
And I spoke with Ted and really enjoyed it. I never had a chance to teach it. It was almost like I had a pretty full plate.
Yes.
Trying to teach modern Western square dancing, and at that same time I was teaching rounds.
Sure.
So it was difficult to involve myself in the contra aspects.
Yes, right. How about round dancing?
Yeah, round dancing. We did round dancing. I learned that when my parents were learning how to round dance, and I always stayed up on it. Tom and Barbara Potts from Massachusetts.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Were people that influenced me in learning to cue rounds. Dot Allen from Allen's Homestead used to cue rounds,
yeah.
Just like Barbara Smith did over
right.
at
Bay Path
Barn.
Yeah.
And so I started cueing rounds when I was had an operation going at Bay Path Barn twice a week.
Right.
And I would come in at 8 o'clock to do my workshop, and I would call and cue, call, cue, and call and cue to 10:30.
Yeah.
No breaks.
Yeah.
Just straight through. And it was fun. Man, I enjoyed it.
Yeah. Well, one of the questions I've been asking a lot of the callers, do you have any regrets? Is there anything that you wish you'd ever done differently?
How can anybody go through life without having a regret?
Yeah.
I don't have any regrets that nag me, Bob. When I think about my tenure in square dancing and square dance calling, I don't have regrets pop into my mind is the first thing I think of. What would I do differently? I'm not sure what I would do differently. I think I would focus more on trying to be more effective in the leadership role and trying to effect some significant change in the direction that square dancing was going.
Yes.
I think that Caller Lab was a bold effort in its time, and it got so... The Caller Lab is an organization, and by that I mean the initial founders of Caller Lab were so hung up on what the impact Caller Lab would have to them and their careers.
Right.
That they were almost to the point of being paranoid about it. And that paranoia hung over the organization for several generations after they had lent their leadership to it.
That's interesting.
And it's that type of paranoia that has caused that organization, in my somewhat less than humble opinion, perhaps, to be frozen into inactivity. They were afraid to do anything.
Yeah.
They were afraid to do anything that would cause any segment of the membership to react.
Yeah.
They were looking for, and these are my terms only, because I'm sure I'm the only one who views it this way, they were highly successful in striving for mediocrity. And they, as a result, I think the square dance leadership function. Now, when I say they, you need to know I'm speaking of myself.
Oh, yes.
Because I spent 5 years on the board of directors. I was on the executive committee for 2 years and was even elected to the vice chair of that organization. And in my capacity, I was unable to be effective.
Yeah.
So I'm being self-critical.
Right. Well, so you keep thinking back to Ed Gilmore's advice.
Ed Gilmore, I think. Ed Gilmore was conflicted.
Yes.
There's no question in my mind about it. And,
yeah.
I kept thinking, I think maybe the relationship that I had with some of the leaders back in that time frame, and I don't claim to have run with them, I was fortunate enough to be able to hear them and speak with them once in a while.
Yeah.
they had an impact on me.
Yes.
They could see it moving. Curly Custer could see things moving way, way too fast.
Yeah.
You know, here's a guy who got more mileage out of a horseshoe turn than anybody I've ever heard of in my life. I bet you if he's calling today, he's still calling horseshoe
yeah.
turn. Partner tag, partner trade, horseshoe turn. Partner tag, partner trade, horseshoe turn. And yet a guy who was so adamant about
yeah.
a lot of the changes that were occurring and
yeah.
the numbers of calls that were coming in. Bob Osgood, fabulous leader. I mean, you know, for me to say anything praiseworthy of Bob Osgood is that you'd lose my voice in the crowd because
sure.
he was just such a tremendous leader.
Yes.
And he brought sense and stability to the organization, to Call Lab when it
right.
was needed.
Yep.
He not only fathered it along and everybody treated him as a paternal figure, but he also had vision.
Yes.
And he could see. And you talk about conflicted. I think that man was conflicted. I honestly believe that he sensed that square dancing might be going the wrong way, and yet he had a lot of confidence in the ability of the leaders that surrounded him to help guide square dancing
right.
away from the precipice.
Yeah.
Now, I don't think the square dancing is headed for a precipice. I think it's going to go through a metamorphosis. I think it has to shut down, go through a metamorphosis, go through some change. It needs to get back into the hands of the local caller and local citizenry and out of the hands of the national and international organizations.
Right.
I think that once square dancing becomes what it originally was, and that is a rural, localized community folk activity, that it will once again rise like a phoenix, and it'll be something that everybody be worthwhile doing.
Well, do you think the community dance program is the answer?
I was involved when I was in Call Lab in trying to help and promote the community dance program. I think that there's a lot of merit to that. To that program.
Yes.
I think, if anything, that program suffers from organizational stresses. And if they would just, again, I'm a firm believer in a type of, I don't believe in fascism, and I think that's the state that square dancing is in right now. I think that people are putting more energy into trying to lead the organization. And if they put some of that energy into developing it instead of just trying to force leadership on it,
yeah,
that it would come around better.
Uh-huh.
The community dance program is an example of that. What they need to do is they need to get out and do it.
Yeah.
Not talk about it, not plan it, not try to write books about it. They need to do it.
Yeah. Well, Kip, I couldn't end this conversation without talking about your hobby. So I know you said I might not have enough tape.
I don't have enough tape there.
Well, just give me a thumbnail sketch.
Well, I've been interested in aviation since I was a kid. As I said before, I'm a private pilot, though I'm not current at the time. So I released my energy by getting involved in competition aerobatics with giant scale radio controlled airplanes. And I build them from a set of plans and a box of wood. We build these airplanes that weigh in the neighborhood of 35 to 40 pounds. They're approximately 130 inches in wingspan. We need a van to transport them around. And they're actually flown with a small twin-cylinder engine that weighs about 8 pounds but generates 16 pounds, I should say 16 horsepower,
uh-huh.
which is the approximate horsepower of the Wright brothers used when they first flew.
Is that right?
So it's an amazing technology with the digital radio equipment that we have today and a lot of the composites that we use, we can build very powerful and very large airplanes that are very light. And so I travel around on weekends, about two weekends a month, in competition and with other giant-scale aerobatic pilots.
There you go.
And
is that more?
Just have a wonderful time.
Is that mostly in Northern California?
Well, it's in the western region, which includes Northern California, Southern California, Nevada, Arizona, Colorado, Utah.
Yeah.
And
that's interesting. Will these things do acrobatics?
Oh yeah, that's exactly what we do. We fly the same aerobatic patterns as the full scale aerobatic pilots fly.
Yes,
but of course it's reduced down.
Sure.
But we fly exactly the same type of figures: the loops, the Cuban eights, the hammerheads, the stall turns, the Humpty bumps, and we fly a very strict pattern, a sequence of pattern, and we were judged on it, and we have a ranking, and it's just great fun.
Yeah. You do barrel rolls?
Oh, yeah. All kinds of rolls, including rolling circles.
Fractional rolls?
Yeah. Two-point rolls, four-point rolls, eight-point rolls.
Is that right?
We do rolling circles with rolls in one direction, followed by rolls in the opposite direction.
Uh-huh.
And it's...
I don't think I ever did one except clockwise. But...
Well, the patterns that the patterns that we fly are the same that are used in full-scale competition.
That's interesting. Yeah.
Snap rolls, barrel rolls.
Immelmans,
yeah.
Whatever. You know, you can't do outside loops, can you?
We sure can.
Can you really?
You name it.
I'll be darned. Oh, that's great.
Yeah, we have a great time.
Well, have you suffered any casualties?
You don't build and fly these airplanes without knowing that one of two things will happen to them. You'll either sell them or you'll crash them.
Is that right?
So they just don't last forever.
And, yeah.
I've lost one giant scale airplane. I have a friend of mine that just within the last 4 weeks have lost three of them. And it does happen.
Yeah.
It just does happen. Of course, we build enough technology into these airplanes that it doesn't happen very often.
Yeah. But you build these from scratch, I take it.
That's right.
Yeah. Any such thing as a kit? Is that it?
Well, there are kits available.
Yeah.
The builder kits are few and far between. There's only two companies now that make builder kits for these size airplanes.
Uh-huh.
There are a number of companies that pre-build the airplanes over in Asia,
right,
and ship them back over here, and you can buy them in one of two completed stages. You can buy them what we call bare bones, and you have to cover them and put the finish on.
Uh-huh.
You can buy them in what they call ARF, which stands for almost ready to fly, and it has the vinyl covering on it, and all you have to do is put your engine and your radio equipment in and just assemble the airplane.
Yeah.
It takes about 4 months to build one.
Uh-huh.
And it takes about two and a half weeks to put an ARF together and fly it.
I see. So I was going to ask you if there were a fabric covering, is that it?
Yeah, we use a vinyl covering.
Vinyl?
Called monocoat or ultracoat.
Uh-huh.
And it's a heat-sensitive plastic covering.
Yeah.
It's very sturdy. It comes in just a rainbow of colors.
Yeah.
It's not cheap.
Right.
And it stretches out over the airframe, and you apply heat to it, and it shrinks.
I see.
And sucks itself in. So we're not doping the airplanes like they used to do.
Right. Did you know Ali Helsel had a hobby of that same type?
I didn't know that Lee was involved in that. Lee and Bill Peters were the ones who gave me my oral exam for call a coach.
Uh-huh.
And, but I had no idea at the time that Lee was involved in that.
Yeah. In fact, Flippo told me this weekend that he lost part of a couple of fingers working in his workshop. And I assume it was on that.
Well, these airplanes will do it.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. Well, it's so interesting to me. I don't know if you knew that I was a pilot myself.
I didn't know that, Bob.
Yeah, I was a P-47 pilot in WW2. Yeah, I flew three missions out of England on D-Day.
Wow.
And well, get this.
I made a P-47 once when I was a smaller one. Before I was involved in competition, built it up. It's a favorite of the Warbird modelers.
Yeah. Well, that's great. Well, this has certainly been a very, very interesting conversation, Kip, and I appreciate you taking the time to call me and let me know you're available. And anything else you think of before we sign off?
Oh, no, not really, except I'm currently not calling at the time I'm working for HP, but I'm not retired from calling, if you know what I mean.
Uh-huh.
I will once again pick up the microphone and call some more.
Yeah, do you do one-night stands?
I did, but I haven't recently. My involvement with HP for the past 5 years has precluded me from committing myself to anything in the evenings.
Yeah.
I work cross-divisionally and cross-functionally with a lot of our Asia HP employees.
Yeah.
That means I have to be available late evenings.
Yes. Well, for the tape, HP stands for?
Hewlett-Packard.
Hewlett-Packard, right. Okay, well, I wish you a lot of luck in the future, Kip, and I'll send you Curly's address, anybody else's you might want.
Oh, golly. That'd be great. I'd just love to ping Curly and see what he's doing.
Yes, well, I'm sure he'd love to talk with you.
Yeah, if you happen to have Deco Dex flying around, I'd like to speak.
Yeah, I wrote to him just the other day, as a matter of fact, in the ContraLab Quarterly, a comment came out, and I sent him I'll send you that along at the same time.
Great.
So, all right. Well, thank you again very much, Kip, and we'll be talking with you.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, lots of luck.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.